Welcome back to After the Buzzer. I am Gordy Jones, and joining me from Gross Estates in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, is that Mike Gross. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Gordy.
And also joining us on the phone line is Frank Bodani of the New York Daily Record. Hello, Frank.
Good to be with you guys. It's wonderful. Like old times.
Right. Except that I missed the World Headquarters.
Yes.
And I missed Jasper.
Yes, and Jasper misses you, no doubt. There's no doubt about that.
But we have a thing. Jasper and I have a thing.
Jasper, for our vast listening audience, I have a Shih Tzu named Jasper who is possibly the friendliest dog ever. And Mike and he have struck up a great friendship. So.
Absolutely. Anyway.
But we don't want to talk about that so much as we want to talk about a very big football game this Saturday, and that is Penn State, 5-0 and ranked fourth in the country, visits Iowa, which is also 5-0 and ranked third. So I just let's start it off this way, gentlemen, since you guys have been following the Knits for a long time. What are you going to look for right out of the chute as far as Penn State? What are the telltale signs about how they're going to do on Saturday?
You mean see what we see during the game?
Yeah. What are you going to look for? What does Penn State need to do? Job one?
It's easy to say they've got to run the ball a little bit. I think Sean Clifford has to fit the ball into tight spots without throwing it to the other team. I think that's a big part of this with Iowa, the way they play defense. And as important it is to Penn State control the ball effectively.
Frank, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, the big deal is not, and Mike Yersh has talked about this today, not turning the ball over. Mm-hmm. So, however that goes, I don't know if they have to run this or run that, but they just can't turn it over because what it's done is, like, Iowa's done this well, but I think it's almost become a belief in themselves that we will be able to get the turnovers and give our offense a short field, because if you don't turn it over to them, suddenly Iowa's very kind of suspect offense is going to have to work for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think between Jordan Stout and not making mistakes from Clifford and you know, holding on the ball, make Iowa's offense work for it, and then all of a sudden right there you have an advantage.
To your point, Iowa is number one in the nation in turnover margin. They are plus 12 and have forced 16 turnovers through five games. They are also second in the nation in scoring defense, giving up 11.5 points a game. Seventh in the nation in total defense, giving up a little under 272. 11th in rushing defense, 87 yards a game. 27th in passing defense. And meanwhile, as you also mentioned, Frank, their offense is pretty ordinary. They're dead last in the Big Ten in total offense, averaging 320 yards a game. So yeah, I mean, it is a strategic game, and if they don't put the ball on the ground, I would think that would bode pretty well for them right out of the chute.
Yeah, I agree with that. I went into this week expecting that I was going to favor Iowa and probably going to pick Iowa. I did not realize how bad their offense has been.
Yeah,
I mean. We sat and watched five games and thought it's hard to believe how bad Penn State has been running the ball. They've run the ball better than Iowa has.
Yeah, yeah.
Per game and per carry.
Right.
I think Penn State's defense against Iowa's offense is a mismatch in Penn State's favor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Frank?
Yeah, I think, Iowa does have, I think, a dangerous running back Goodson, and especially coming out of the backfield, getting him in space. But if you can stop the run right away, you know, keep them kind of pinned back a little bit, then all of a sudden the table sways inordinately toward Penn State. If they can keep track of the, if they can keep on their hands on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've done a really good job of that actually this year.
Mm-hmm.
Clifford's had one bad mistake, which was last week. He really didn't throw a bad interception since then. He hasn't fumbled the ball away since then. Penn State's been great at holding onto the ball.
Yeah.
So if you can continue that, then I think the game looks completely different. It's just, I don't know, you know, I guess until they do it, it's kind of hard to know if they can. There's always the flashback to me of 0-5 last year,
right,
with Clifford. And until you get a little more down the way, it's just hard to completely get that out of the back of my mind. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wonder, since I've never been to Iowa, I wonder if both of you could just describe the atmosphere there, because it is, James Franklin has talked about this often, about how the fans are kind of right on top of you, and it is kind of a unique stadium feel. What is your read on that kind of road atmosphere?
Yeah, I think it's a lot noisier than places like Michigan, for example,
mm-hmm.
for that reason, because of the way the stadium is sort of built, and they are right on top of the fans are right on top of the players.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of the better atmospheres in the Big Ten, one of the best, maybe, I guess, atmospheres in the Big Ten, and they have that really cool moment at the end of the first quarter where they do the thing with the kids in the hospital across the street. That's really neat, and
mm-hmm.
But I think it's one of the best in the Big Ten, don't you think, Frank?
Oh, it definitely is. I think it's more of a show. I think James Franklin's teams have done pretty well in the most hostile environments, meaning they played pretty well at Ohio State, they played well at Iowa,
mm-hmm.
Wisconsin, they handled that. And the thing is that Clifford's and some of these guys have been to Kinnick before, and they won there.
Mm-hmm.
He has won there. Noah Cain's won there. Brisker's won there. I think at least that's at least a good sign. I don't know. I'm not saying the crowd's not going to have an effect, but I think that's a good sign for Penn State that they've been able to go there with some of these guys and do it. They went to Wisconsin the first game of the year. Mm-hmm. And I thought they handled that pretty well. So it's a great scene,
mm-hmm.
but I think I like Penn State's attitude on defense, and I think what I mean by that is they seem like they have the type of guys that are a little bit nasty, a little intimidating mm-hmm. at times, and I think they'll actually eat this up. I think they would like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good call. And we should, as Frank just alluded to there. The last two times they went there, 2017 and 2019,
mm-hmm.
they won
right.
really close games.
Right.
You know, close, tense games, kind of like you imagine this is going to be on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, to that point, it was 17-12 in 19 and 21-19 in 2017. So, yeah. In fact, they've won their last three there. They won in 2012, they won 38-14 at Iowa, which is a little surprising. So, and overall, they're 10-5 at Iowa. So, I'm guessing that's something you can put in your back pocket. At the same time, there's this. I saw a stat today about James Franklin. His teams all time are 0-9 against top 10 teams on the road, and 0-7 at Penn State. And I don't know. I'm sure that certainly feeds into the whole notion that a lot of people have that he's a great recruiter and not necessarily a great strategist, but I just wonder what goes through your minds when you hear a stat like that.
Right.
Okay, well, here, I'll tell you what goes through my mind. I think that they've been at, well, I'll go this way. I think they might have his best coaching staff that he's since he's been at Penn State right now. So I think I like the way his coordinators right now took over. He was, I didn't think his staff was as good as it is now, quite mm-hmm. as good, and I think he was still dealing with a deficiency.
Right.
If, you know, the first couple of years you go to Ohio State or something with a team he took over, it's still a little bit of a struggle.
Right.
That's not fair.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked his two coordinators to be able to handle this now.
Mm-hmm.
So we can look in the past, and I think that's valid. But I think the guys really kind of controlling the game are going to be Mike Yurcich and Brent Pry. And I'm going to kind of try to wipe the slate just a little bit clean this year and see kind of how this goes, because I have a different feel. I'm still wanting to see what Mike Yurcich is bringing, and we don't fully know yet, because
mm-hmm.
I think there's more to be had there, which is intriguing and interesting and probably a good sign for Penn State fans.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm interested to see what he does. I thought Franklin, this is what I wanted to ask Yurcich about, if I could figure out how to ask a damn question. But Franklin said the other day that, well, they Iowa plays zone coverage all the time, and they have their eyes on the quarterback all the time, mm-hmm. as much as anybody in college football. I really wanted to hear him, expand on that a little bit. But I'm interested in seeing what he comes up with on Saturday. You know how Iowa's going to line up all the time. That's what they say. So tight ends, the wide receiver screen stuff. I mean, it seems like we've got pieces of the arsenal in different games
mm-hmm.
so far. Maybe we get the whole arsenal on Saturday or closer to it.
Yeah, I think he's a good adjuster so far, he's shown, and taking what teams will give him and then quickly countering. I think in the past, Penn State fans have been so frustrated as to that point. It's like, oh my gosh, why are we not adjusting here?
Yeah.
And I think Mike has at least shown that he seems to be able to do that. And I think Penn State has more weapons. And I look at their, like you mentioned, their tight end room. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more to get from those guys. Theo Johnson is going to be an NFL stud.
Mm-hmm.
And we're only seeing the tip of that. And mm-hmm. I think there's more to come with there. And I think the running backs have still not been a focus, really, especially in the pass game. I think there's more to be had there. And I think to me, the last key there is your number three and maybe four receiver. Mm-hmm. Lambert Smith is starting to get it, I think.
Yeah,
he can just take another little step and make defenses fully be responsible for him. That's going to be huge too. And maybe, you know, you don't know what week that's coming. Maybe he gets a little more involved too this week. So
the other thing maybe for Saturday is Clifford as a runner, mm-hmm. which is sort of a wild card thing. That maybe this defense that plays position responsibility so well all the time and is trying to get everything covered, maybe that's a wild card factor, because he has runs pretty effectively.
I think he's run better this year, scrambling, keeping his eyes down the field. You can see it from the press.
Oh, that's a clear improvement, yeah. Whether that's Yurcich or just him figuring it out,
right.
That is a clear improvement.
Yeah,
because you see how he puts the defense in conflict. Like, look at Indiana. What do you do when he's rolling and then he knows where the line of scrimmage is? Like, he's confident doing that.
Mm-hmm. There were two big plays in that game where he knows where the line of scrimmage is. You can see him pull up so he doesn't cross it and really burn him for big plays. I think in both cases, maybe not, that's not right.
They were both touchdowns.
One was a touchdown to the tight end, right?
Yeah, the first was a touchdown to Brenton Strange, and I'm pretty sure the other one was when he threw it to Dotson, who scored.
Yep, that's right. But yeah, that to me is a clear improvement in him, mm-hmm. it seems like. Or this thing where when he sort of gives up on his hot read or whatever,
right.
He gets off, he's looking down the field and he's not frantic, and he's really been pretty effective at that.
And I like that he was kind of salty at his press conference yesterday. Like, he's got a little attitude.
About what?
Maybe you want to punch him a little bit. I like that, though.
What did he get salty about?
Just his whole attitude. His demeanor was a little bit just like, I've answered some of these questions before. I'm just ready to go kick his butt.
Well, he was, if you remember last year when they were losing, he was really belligerent. and did not, right? Don't you think?
Didn't
want to talk at all, and Franklin had to drag him out in front of us, dude, you're getting your ass kicked every week. I mean, come on. And, what do you expect? So there's a little bit of that, too. I agree.
Yeah, going through the numbers, Clifford to date completed 67%, 1,300 yards, 11 touchdowns, 3 interceptions. So he is off to a nice start through the first five. And, I dare say that maybe he's playing the way you would hope an experienced quarterback would play, knowing that there are far better teams down the road. Is that how you guys would read it to this point?
Yeah, and I didn't think he had a great game on Saturday. I thought his best game was Auburn.
Yeah.
I thought he was terrific
yeah.
in that game.
Yeah, he was good.
And then other games, you know, they were able to, like against Villanova, they get the ball to the receivers in space and boom, it's over, you know.
Right.
Although he played really well in that game. And so, to some extent, the second half of Wisconsin, too, getting it down the field. But, I think he's been very good. I really do. I think he's been great.
Frank, you...
Yeah, I say perfect. You know, he's got enough experience. If you're going to come back from what he happened last year, you get the coordinator you want to help you.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of lines up a little bit that we're seeing the best that we can see in this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's still a little bit more maybe finessing or a little more smoothing of some edges. I mean, I think there's still a little more to get from him with his confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think last week him and his receivers were not on as much.
Mm-hmm.
But what I liked from him, and we just talked about the way he handled those particular plays, the confidence in scrambling, that's got to put some fear into you're trying to prepare for Penn State, is the way he handled those situations and plays in particular. Because even if he didn't do everything nearly as well in some ways last week, those he did really well.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's like, I don't know how you guard that. That's a great thing. He did not have that. To me, he did not really have that down until this season, and especially the way he handled it. He just looks more confident, more sure of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good thing. And I think he's, no matter what Iowa does, I think he's as ready. I would be surprised if at least he doesn't come out and play pretty well, because mm-hmm. I think he's, you know, at this point, everything going, I mean, he's ready for this. I guess we'll learn a lot about both teams. Like, how good is Iowa's defense, really?
Mm-hmm.
Because this isn't like Maryland's kind of flaky second-year quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
That they can just kind of mesmerize or whatever they did last week in the 6 interception.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a test. You'll learn about them, and you'll learn about Penn State. I think you'll get a better feel of who's really a top 5 or 10 team.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that's related to that is, I think the receivers have gotten better at working with Clifford when he's extending the play.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, breaking off their routes and finding a way to run around and get open. Their receivers are really a strength, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think Washington and, of course, Dotson, I think, is probably one of the best players in the country. And Washington is very good, too.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said earlier, Frank, Lambert is coming. Lambert Smith is, mm-hmm. is coming. Yeah.
So,
yeah, they're a little short there to me, and other as far as numbers, but the guys they got going, I mean, Dotson and Washington are, Dotson could be a podcast himself.
Yeah.
I didn't think he had it in him a couple of years ago, but, you know, numbers-wise, you'd like to see a couple more guys as receivers. They really only use three. I mean.
Yeah, and I think that it's not just that you'd like to run guys in and out, it's that you'd like to be able to use some 4 and 5 receiver formations sometimes, and they rarely do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, they use the tight end in formationally a lot more than maybe other teams do.
Mm-hmm.
But, they rarely use more than three.
Until Cam Sullivan Brown catches a ball, I can't regard him as a threat when he's out there.
Cam Sullivan Brown and Daniel George have been at Penn State for 16 years. production per year out, they have not distinguished themselves.
Oh, and I think Yursich is a very strict teacher and disciplinarian when it comes to who's getting on the field, and I think he's using Tyler Warren as the third tight end all the time, maybe partly because he doesn't think the other receivers are worth getting on the field at this point. So you got to have somebody out there.
You got to assume that. You got to assume that's the case. And that tight end, it's funny that tight end group is so, like, all three of them are guys that you're totally comfortable having out there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Frank, you just touched on something that I found interesting. You said that a couple years ago you weren't sure that the LiPo was ever going to go off for Dotson. What do you think has changed for him in the time since then? What really did he kind of finally grasp that he became the player that he obviously now is?
Well, it sounded like maybe just confidence, mm-hmm. and getting to adjust to this level. I mean, he seems like he did all the things he's doing now he did in high school.
Mm-hmm.
From talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
But at Penn State, it almost just seemed like, you know, he needed to be able to handle the spotlight a little bit. And we go back to his play at Minnesota when he's streaking down the field for the go-ahead, maybe winning points, and he kind of stumbles and looks back and falls, and Penn State never scores.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about how that play in particular, the play like that, has driven him since then for 2 years.
Interesting.
And it's just that everybody says he's the hardest worker, but yet he's so smooth, mm-hmm. you don't always think he's working running fast. He's so quiet,
mm-hmm.
you know, he doesn't draw attention to himself like other guys in the
mm-hmm.
past.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that and I guess with receivers, this is hard for us to know. Like Kirk Ferentz said, no wasted motion.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, like he runs precisely where he wants to go
mm-hmm.
all the time. Everything is, I mean, now he's developed, he's got the hands, and he doesn't ever drop one.
Doesn't seem like it.
I don't know if he's had a drop this year yet.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that yours just mentioned is he's developed a little, the icing is his toughness now. So every time he catches the ball, he's not afraid to put his helmet down and get two, three more yards. And he's not a big guy, but he's developed enough strength. That's another part of his game now
mm-hmm.
that, I don't know. He just, I guess anybody who looks like he does, which means like an average dude walking down the street.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say that,
do the things that he does.
Yeah, you see him walking down the street, you're not thinking elite football player at all. That's really true. I can't even add anything to what Frank just said. I think he covered it. I think it was more with him, confidence, toughness, just sort of marinating and being a big time
yes.
football player for a while, and that's where we are. So I didn't really see this coming either. I mean, you know, I remember I talked to him at the he won the state long jump championship when he was a sophomore in high school, completely out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like people were surprised that he even made the state meet, and he was very quiet and unassuming and did not seem like I knew that Penn State was recruiting him. You know, that's why I sort of made a point to talk to him. And very unassuming kid, and he's come a long way in a lot of areas.
You know, Frank, this is something we tossed around with Dave Jones last week on the podcast. We just talked about comparing Jahan to some of the great receivers Penn State has had in recent years, like Allen Robinson and Chris Godwin. Where would you put him in that group? He obviously belongs in that conversation. I think I would take Godwin above him because he was such a specimen. But Jahan has really acquitted himself incredibly well these last 2 years. So I would never want to give him short shrift, but I think that's probably how I would put it. I would probably go Godwin, then Jahan, and then Allen. Although Allen was, that's a tough call too. How do you look at that?
Oh, I love this question because, okay, so 30 years, basically since they've been in the Big Ten, Bobby Engram, number one.
Yep, I agree. I absolutely agree with that.
Allen Robinson, you know, I would have liked to see just another year of him, but yeah, he was his last year, he just was unstoppable physically, and he didn't drop balls ever.
Yeah,
it's hard to argue with that. Now, the two guys that kind of remind me more of Dotson, it's because of their builds, are Deion Butler, Jordan Norwood.
Yeah,
and
he's better than both of them. He's better than both of them.
They were guys you look like. You could just like tap on their chest and they'd fall over, but they were tough. Butler like never dropped the ball either. Jordan, great hands,
mm-hmm.
and they were similar built to Jahan.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, as far as ranking them, I mean, to me, let's see. If more to go in this season, I think I'd be apt to put Jahan up with any of them. They may different type of receiver than Chris Godwin, but. depending on how this last half of the season goes, I'd be right there with putting him up at the very top two or three.
He's been great. I mean, and just as you mentioned, his hands have just been, you know, incredible. The catch against Ohio State last year has got to rank in the top five ever at Penn State.
It does, and the thing is, he didn't just flash that. Now it's every game he's doing. And those guys we just mentioned are the thing that separates them. It was every game.
Yeah.
Once they got it going.
That's right.
Ohio State, it was now he skywalked to get that ball at Auburn. I don't know how he caught the ball last week. It looked like it was going 2 feet over his head when Clifford.
Yeah, I thought he missed. I thought Clifford was semi-throwing that away. And then when you saw it in a replay, I mean, it wasn't.
But smooth.
Yeah.
Smooth.
Kind of smooth, yeah.
Harder than what he makes. He makes it look easier, which is another thing. You know,
he reminds me a little bit of the guy that won the Heisman last year.
Oh, Devontae Smith. Yeah, that's interesting.
A slightly built guy.
Yeah.
Not a lot of wasted motion. He just reminds me a little bit of him.
That's interesting.
Of course, on the Eagles now.
Yeah, I like that. And correct me if I'm wrong, but did Jahan come in the same year as Justin Shorter, or was he ahead of him?
That's a good question.
At any rate,
Justin Shorter. Wow.
My point being that Justin came in with all this hype and everybody thought he was going to be the next great receiver, and just things never quite worked out, and he ended up leaving, and he was a physical freak, and now this guy is, you know, he's going to put himself right there with all the great receivers in school history. It's just funny how things work out, and I'm sure part of that is we don't know the entire picture. We probably will never know. You know, did he work hard? What was he like in the classroom? What was he like in practice, et cetera, et cetera. But still, you know, it's funny how things work out sometimes.
Yeah, you're right. I remember Shorter was a really elite recruit.
Yes, he was.
I mean, he was a big-time guy, and I talked to his high school coach on the phone, and of course, his high school coach, oh, this kid's an unbelievable hard worker. He's an awesome kid.
Right.
He roomed with Grayson Klein from Warwick.
Okay.
And Grayson Klein, I remember, told me, he's an awesome guy. He's a great guy, you know, and all of that. So, I don't know. And he's done okay since he left.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And Juwan Johnson, I saw Juwan Johnson scored a touchdown in the NFL the other day.
He scored two against the Green Bay Packers, so let's not talk about him.
I'm sorry to bring that up. He's done okay, too, right? I mean,
He's a tight end now, Juwan.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, they moved him to tight end, yes. So that's interesting.
So because I guess the moral of the story is don't listen to the high school coach.
Or if you're Penn State, don't take a really big receiver. Just go with the kind of the slider guys.
Maybe that's what I mean. If you think about it, that is the guys who've had the most success. I mean, Deshaun Hamilton was a really good player for them, and he was not enormous, you know. Yeah. And so it's.
Well, how big is Allen Robinson?
Not huge.
Allen Robinson's kind of a little more the outlier. Maybe he was a little bigger guy, I thought. But
he seems rangy to me. I don't know. But maybe
he's 6'3". I didn't realize Allen was that tall. Okay.
Yeah. One of the few guys physically that his last year where you put him on the field and he just dominated physically. Like, he almost looked like he was on another level than the guys were claiming it.
And has had a really respectable NFL career, too. So,
and some.
This is a sort of a side journey, but a little earlier in the conversation, we're just talking about how Penn State's tight end room has been so strong. And it's kind of curious to me because that was kind of always Bill O'Brien's thing. Like, let's use the tight ends. And now it's sort of sneaking into the mix for James Franklin / Mike Yurcich. I mean, are there any comparisons to be drawn with Mike Yurcich's offensive philosophy and Bill O'Brien's, do you think?
I think that O'Brien used them in a different way. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, he actually had different tight end positions.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Like,
yeah.
Like a Z and something else, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought he used them in a much different way. What I've seen is with Yurcich is they kind of go down the seam a little bit more in the middle of the field.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas O'Brien had that thing where they were on different levels, mm-hmm. you know, multiple receivers on different levels, and you could sort of, the defense had to cover one of them, you know.
Right.
But the other thing is that these two guys, right away, these guys that they're playing now, right away were pretty good blockers.
Mm-hmm.
Big physical guys who were pretty good blockers. Now, they've had some slip-ups in that area the last couple of weeks, but mm-hmm. but in general, they've been pretty good. So that means you can play right away and maybe help in the run game.
Right.
You know, so they lost Freiermuth and didn't really lose that much.
Mm-hmm. Frank, what's your take on the Obi Yurcich comparison?
Well, they're both kind of offensive wizards mm-hmm. in a way, which mm-hmm. means that they just are creative.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this position that I don't think people utilize enough. They do, mm-hmm. and they're creative about it. You know, they're taking Tyler Warren, who was a high school quarterback, and they're making him, they're running him out there all over the field, even though he doesn't touch the ball a whole lot. And mm-hmm. I just think that Mike is able to, here's what I got to work with. Like Bill O'Brien when he came, you know,
yeah.
we don't have everything we need, maybe, but this is what we got to work with,
mm-hmm.
and we're creative enough to use it to our advantage.
Mm-hmm. Including using Tyler as a wildcat quarterback, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, they've got to be setting that stuff up for like a 3rd and 2
mm-hmm.
or later in the year where he's going to actually chuck the ball.
So,
foot soft pedal that way.
So this is a... this is another thing that has emerged recently, media-wise, how after last season, some of the players approached James Franklin and said, you need to work us harder. I mean, did that surprise you guys at all? Because every year, everybody says that they work the hardest they've ever worked in the offseason, but this is maybe kind of an admission that they needed to take it up another notch. I wonder, Frank, what your reaction was when you saw those reports.
You know, I thought good leadership. I mean, I think some of these guys really came back, like Dotson, in part, obviously, always for themselves, but, like, we were part of one of the worst Penn State teams ever.
Mm-hmm.
We're turning this around, so how do we do it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we need to work a little harder. Maybe there's some way we can challenge ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe a little more symbolic than anything. I don't know. You know, the differences between how hard his first year was and his third year and this year. And,
right.
you know, we don't have all those guys here to compare it to. But I think it was a symbolic move. But I think a lot of this is about togetherness. And they don't want any way to repeat what happened last year because it was embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Mike,
yeah, two things on that. One, after the players came out and said that, like on Tuesday and after the game, they asked Franklin about that on Wednesday at the post-practice thing, and he said, I don't remember that. He said, I don't remember that happening. He said it may have happened, but I don't really remember that. But then he also said that they changed the way they conditioned this offseason a little bit and ran a lot more so that they were in better general conditioning shape heading into August.
Okay.
Heading into preseason camp. And Derek Tangelo, the defensive tackle from Duke,
mm-hmm.
transferred in. He talked about that a little bit. He says, man, I can't believe how much they're running. You know, I'm a 300-pound dude. I don't run, you know. So maybe that was a factor. I don't know.
And here's the interesting thing. I don't know if you can draw a straight line or not, but Derek made that play a couple games ago where I guess it was against Auburn, where he pursued down the line and ran a guy down at the sideline. And that's sort of become a symbolic play about how they've been playing to date. So again, who knows if you can draw a straight line, but he was there to make the play and he ran the guy down. So that's something.
Yeah, we always, I think when a team goes from struggling and then figuring it out, we always want to find these intangible things
right.
that are the explanation for it. And sometimes they are,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes it's just a load of crap that we're trying to pull out, you know. And, I think that Franklin was a mental and emotional mess last year.
Yeah.
Because of COVID. I really do. And because of not being separated from his family, I just don't think he was himself in terms of personality and energy and work habits. And at one point, I remember him saying, I'm going to turn all this COVID stuff over to the team doctors and just coach football in practice from now on.
Interesting.
You know, I think maybe it, you know, it got away from him a little bit last year. Maybe.
Frank, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think he's everything thrives on family, energy. Penn State works a certain way under him, and that was, it was like he took the air out of the room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. More than right. others, and I think they've gotten that back, mm-hmm. and they're able to take better advantage of all the things that make them potentially good or better than others. All their advantages kind of are a little more in place.
Right.
And I think they just couldn't use them last year. I mean, the things that make them special, or so to speak, they just, other schools could adapt differently and better, and Penn State really struggled, and now things are back to normal to some degree, and they're able to be who they are, and they feel good about it, and I think it all builds. And yeah, he's a big emotion guy and a big energy guy. He's different than Kirk Ferentz, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's pretty much polar opposites, to say the least. Yeah, it's whatever works. Now, of course, the reports a couple weeks ago, there's a lot of speculation that USC is going to make a run at Franklin. How likely, Frank, do you believe it is that he might take a serious look and or go in that direction?
I think it's all about, does he want to live in SoCal or not with his family and move across? I think the advantages are clear. If he wants to do it and he feels like it's a fit for him and his wife and his two girls. But the thing none of us know is, how's he feel about that ultimately?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it'd be easier to win a league title and go to the playoffs, and you got these recruiting advantages, and he could, personality could handle it. But in the end, does he want to do it? Does he want to go 3,000 miles away
mm-hmm.
with family and live there?
Mm-hmm.
And do it there. And I don't know. I mean, you know, when it comes down to it, to me, that's what the big thing. It's personal, and I have no idea. There's arguments for both ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes we forget that they're human beings.
Fair.
And he just has to be. Yeah, he and his family have to figure out where they want to live. And I don't know how we can guess at that. I want to tell you what our boy. When our boy Dave said on the way up to Penn State last weekend, he said, "This is going to ruin my Thanksgiving." because it's like to him, it's a done deal that Frank is going to USC. So we're going to have to work on Thanksgiving, dude.
Well, my man.
You know, honestly, if I had to bet one way or the other, I would bet yes, he's gone.
Okay.
No, I'm not totally confident. I wouldn't bet on that. I'm not totally confident. But if I had to bet, if I had to pick one or the other, I would say yes.
Interesting. All right, so that the next logical question is, who's the most likely next head coach of Penn State if that happens? Is Yursich a guy?
Yeah, I think so. Frank?
Mike Munchak, maybe?
No, I don't see him as a recruiter.
Okay.
I'll tell you who I think is number one in the very unlikely event that he's interested in the job. Matt Rhule.
Ooh, that's a good name.
Yeah. I think he's number one if he's interested. And then I think you look at Joe Moorhead.
Ooh.
And I think you look at Bill O'Brien.
Really?
Yeah, I do. And then I think you look at Yursich.
Interesting. Yeah, Matt Rhule's got it going in Carolina now in the NFL.
Yeah, that's really unlikely.
Yeah.
You know, but he would be number one if he's interested, I think.
Boy, he certainly seems to have the golden touch, that's for sure. That's a good name. I like that name. I mean, obviously, they'll have their pick of the litter pretty much. I mean, they can go whatever direction they want. I would think, this is just, you know, speculation on my part, I would think they would go younger than Joe Moorhead. That's just my guess. Don't you think? A younger guy?
Well, how does he compare in age with O'Brien? I don't even know.
I don't know. I'd have to look at it. But that's just my thought. That's why
he looks older because he's grizzled.
Yeah. The grizzled veteran.
Yeah, he's a grizzled veteran.
But that's just my thought. I mean, maybe I'm way off base. But
they probably should throw Brent Pry's name in there too.
That's probably a good name as well. I would think
he would. Yeah, I mean, you should probably throw his name in there too.
Yeah, and certainly I think his record kind of speaks for itself. It seems like every year he figures it out on that side of the ball, so including this year very much.
I don't think he would be seen as a dynamic home run type player to the extent that the other guys I named would.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it's... I mean, obviously he'd take it if they offered it to him. I don't think there's any question about that, but
It is very a speculative thing. Anyway, so okay, let's do this. Let's finish up on this note. Who wins on Saturday, Frank?
Frank out.
Frank might be out.
Yeah, Frank. I think Frank texted that he had a semi emergency, and I think he had to get the mail.
Okay.
Unfortunately, sorry about that.
Okay. I'll
tell you what I think. As I said earlier, I really was going into this week thinking I was going to pick Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people are looking at this game like, well, Penn State has to hold on to the ball to have a chance.
Right.
I sort of think it has flipped in my mind the closer I've looked at it. I think Iowa has to force a bunch of turnovers to have a chance.
Yeah, it seems
so. They have to win that side of it pretty decisively.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's more ways to win for Penn State than there are for Iowa. Again, I didn't realize how bad their offense has been so far.
Yeah, nor did I.
It's almost like a magic trick.
Yeah.
That they've won so comfortably against and beaten some pretty good teams.
Mm-hmm.
And been as bad as they've been. So I like Penn State. I think it's going to be fairly low scoring.
Mm-hmm.
I think if Penn State takes care of the ball, they can win this comfortably.
Yeah, to your point, Iowa, as I mentioned earlier, is dead last in the Big Ten in total offense. They're 12th in rushing offense, 126 yards a game, and 10th in passing offense, 194 yards a game. So, yeah, that
118th in the country.
Yeah, so... but, you know, their defensive numbers are what they are, and the names that I saw just sort of scanning Big Ten stats, they have two defensive linemen, Lucas Van Ness, Zach Van Valkenburg, which is a good Iowa name.
Yeah.
Van Ness, 4 sacks, Zach Van Valkenburg, 5 tackles for loss, and then they have 2 guys in their secondary, Riley Moss has 3 picks, and Matt Hankins has 2. So I suspect it'll be, a hard-hitting kind of affair and low scoring, as you mentioned, and which is tends to be how these games are when both of them are good.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the 2019 game that we referred to was 17-12,
mm-hmm.
and Penn State had a touchdown late. It's interesting. I went back and looked at some of the stuff I wrote about that game, and going into that game, the sort of assessment of this Penn State team was exactly the same 2 years ago as it is now.
How about it? Interesting.
They've thrown the ball decently. They've got explosive plays. They haven't been able to run the ball.
Uh-huh.
That day against that defense, they were able to run the ball. Noah Kane had a huge game. He had 120-some yards, and he only played. He probably didn't play half the game. Maybe he did. But at the end, he was in there. He was almost like he was the closer.
Mm-hmm.
He ran inside. He was able to move the chains and milk the clock.
Mm-hmm.
He was really a critical factor in the game. So that running the ball piece is probably going to have to – that's probably going to have to get ironed out again.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, I'm going to say I think Penn State – I think there's more ways I can see for Penn State to win this game than for Iowa to win.
Okay, that's good. So let's move on to some other topics. We wanted to toss around the latest twist on the Ben Simmons saga. The Sixers have decided they're going to withhold the first payment of $8.25 million to Ben, which reportedly Ben then approached the players' union about whether they can do that, and yes, they can. So they're going to begin garnishing his wages, which is kind of the newest twist. And of course, the NBA, while acknowledging that it is notorious for rumors, the latest rumor is that Indiana has some interest. They were rumored way back when, and to be honest with you, while Daryl Morey is on record as saying that he wants a star back for Simmons, if Indiana comes offering Malcolm Brogdon and Caris LeVert and a pick or whatever, I think you got to think seriously about it, because I think the Sixers.
Pretty good to me too. I when you were naming those guys, guys, I think, I would do that.
Yeah.
I think I would do that. And, you know, Landon could be, he could be your point guard, you know, right?
Brogdon, you mean?
Brogdon.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's a point guard. I think he's damn good. I mean, I think the Sixers will be as much, if not more, of a title threat with those two guys next to what they have as they are, you know, with Simmons for sure. That's.
Yeah, I do too. I would be good with that. I would be surprised. To tell you the truth, I would be surprised if that's on the table.
Yeah.
Because I would think Daryl Morey would be happily pull the trigger on that. I think it tells you something about Ben Simmons that he actually had to go to the Players Union to find out if the Sixers are allowed to not pay him if he's not upholding any of his obligations to the contract.
Yes.
What a child this guy is.
It's apparently there was a wrestling event. I'm not sure if it was last night, the night before, where they launched in an obscene chant about Ben Simmons. So my suspicion is that the first time his new team plays in Philadelphia, he will be scratched with knee soreness or something.
Load management.
Thank you. But at any rate, we'll see how this plays out. As I understand it, this is something somebody a lot smarter than I about this. Bobby Marks said that the next big day is October 18th because Brogdon and LeVert are both eligible for extensions on that day. And if, in fact, Indiana extends both of those guys, then they can't trade them for 6 months. So that would probably, you know, quash that rumor once and for all. So Bobby Marks is all over that stuff, and I heard him talking about it the other day, and I said, okay, I'll keep that date in mind.
Yeah, that sounds like there is some movement.
Yeah.
He's not making that up. There's something going on there. Okay, well, that's good.
Yes.
And the other thing is, then, does that mean that the Sixers would have to come up with new deals for both of those guys?
Yeah, I don't know. There's a question.
I would think probably it does.
Yeah. So, anyway. But the other topic we wanted to toss around is this is the NBA's 75th season, and as such, they're going to come out with the 75 greatest NBA players of all time, which is a very difficult task. And the other week, I was listening to a podcast where Jack McCallum, a former guest of this podcast, and Howard Beck, a longtime NBA writer, were kind of tossing around, you know, just how hard it is and how you can't necessarily just transfer the 50 greatest guys that were picked at the 50th anniversary and just build on that you sort of have to make some revisions. So, I mean, I don't want to go through the whole list or anything like that. I mean, there's some obvious guys. There's probably like 25 guys that you and I could both name that would be really obvious. But after that, then it gets really hard. Well, what are your thoughts on
that? Yeah, it does. It's like anything else. You know, there's the obvious no-brainer greatest ever, and then it gets the group gets bigger and bigger as you move backwards from that. I have so many questions about this.
Right.
Just thinking about, like, if you were in the top 50,
right,
the previous top 50, you mean,
right,
and you're a living guy,
right,
and you're not on the top 75,
right?
I mean, that's a real slight.
I guess
almost like an embarrassing thing, you know.
I get it.
So I can't believe they're going to do that. Are they going to do that?
I don't know if they named anybody specific, but they said that, and it's at least they threw that idea out there. I mean,
it's a possibility. Right. Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, there are a couple other things they mentioned. Obviously, there's the difficulty in comparing eras. And here, this is something we tossed around before we came on the air tonight. And my one small quibble, and, you know, I don't want to make too much of this, about the 50 greatest of all time was Bill Walton, who was obviously a great player when he played, clearly. You know, a champion with the Blazers in 76-77, the best player in the game in 77-78 until he hurt his foot. I mean, the Blazers were 50-10 with him, and then he got hurt. And then he was a sixth man of the year on the Celtics 85-86 team. So, yes, great when he played, but he missed a lot of time. So, and obviously a tremendous college player. So I don't know. That was the one that I've always had qualms about, whether he was one of the 50 greatest of all time.
Oh, here's the interesting. I'm just thinking about this when you were setting that up there with Walton. You know, the Bill James historical abstract about baseball.
Yeah.
He was not able to reconcile the difference between peak value and career value.
Interesting.
So he did two separate lists.
Uh-huh.
And it sounds like Walton would be an extreme example of that.
Yeah, that's a good
value. He may have been the best player in the game for a year and a half,
mm-hmm.
But career value, and then not so much. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, how much of that was just injuries that you can't really hold against him? I mean, I don't know. It's very difficult.
Yeah, the two of the names that Howard and Jack tossed around as being difficult calls were Dominique Wilkins and Tracy McGrady. And I thought that was an interesting discussion. I mean, you know, where they would fit in on a 75 greatest of all time, because obviously, you know, they had their runs, both of them, you know, in Dominique's case, probably a little more extended than Tracy even. But those are the kind of, I don't know, hair splitting things that you go through when you're trying to compile a list like this, you know?
Yeah. Tracy McGrady, it's interesting. There were times when I would watch him play and think, this guy can't be stopped. How does anybody ever guard?
Right.
I mean, he was so skilled and so athletic.
Yes, yes, he was. Yes.
You know, but you know, if you look at the history of the game, if you look at the history of the NBA,
mm-hmm.
you could pull Tracy McGrady out of there and it would not be an apocalyptic game. Right? I mean,
correct.
I say that with all due respect to him. I liked him as a player.
Sure.
But, so, I don't know. Those are two hard ones. I agree. Yeah. Dominique and Tracy McGrady.
Yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah. And two other names they tossed around, and I thought this was an interesting discussion, too. Defensive specialists like Dennis Rodman or Dikembe Mutombo. Now, there are two guys that were obviously game changers in their own unique ways. So, you know, how do you find a spot for either or both of those? I mean, Rodman, I mean, he won a bunch of titles, but then again, a lot of guys won titles with Michael Jordan.
yeah, he won a bunch of titles. Every coach in the history of basketball has talked about the importance of defense and rebounding.
Right.
Well, you know, who was better at those two things than Dennis Rodman?
Yeah,
not many. You know,
not many.
I'm not seriously making this comparison, but he impacted the game somewhat in the way that Bill Russell did.
Yeah,
I'm not comparing it to Bill Russell. Don't you know? But that's a tough one. That's really a tough one. I don't think Dikembe, not quite.
No, in
my view. I mean, a shot blocker. And that's a very specific skill that certainly impacts the game a lot. But I'm not gonna go to Dikembe. Here's another thing. Like currently active players, talent, I guess they
do,
right?
Yes, indeed they do.
So was LeBron the top 50 was pre-LeBron, right?
Yes, that was pre-LeBron.
So it'll be LeBron. It'll be Durant. It'll be Curry.
Yep, all those guys. Yeah. Yeah, there are more
they
than.
They sucked that up.
Yeah, it's not an easy task. I don't envy anybody this task. Obviously they don't mean a whole lot, but I think they're kind of fun to toss around and just kind of discuss and just, you know, what how do you define good? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and the other thing that is so interesting about this is that the role of the center position changed so much. It's almost unbelievable how much that has changed, and that would roughly coincide with the 50-year cutoff and now the 75-year cutoff.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So you're not going to see very many centers the way we thought of Wilt Chamberlain and Kareem as centers.
Mm-hmm.
This new 25 here that we're adding on.
Mm-hmm.
As we were talking about this before we went on, and I said this is the kind of thing that the more you think about it, the more you realize how little you how less strong your convictions are about it, rather than the other way around.
Yeah, here's an example of what you're talking about. The other week I was watching Game 6 of the 1985 Finals between the Celtics and the Lakers, and virtually on every possession there were at least six guys in the lane, if not eight. And now you watch a game and the lane is empty, and I see appeal in both ways of playing. To be honest with you, I'm kind of used to the latter way, but it is just striking how different it was.
Well, it's striking, but I really, it is. There's no doubt about it. But I really felt like that's 1985. That's right around the sweet spot where I thought the game was the best it's ever been.
Yeah.
The right mix of physicality and inside and perimeter. Mm-hmm. Even though there were a lot of bodies in the lane, mm-hmm. the ball moved. Guys were able to make plays. Guys were able to take advantage of their individual skills.
Mm-hmm.
That was the all-time sweet spot of the NBA.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of sentiment in that direction. Here's the other thing that jumped out about that game in particular to me was James Worthy, who kind of gets overshadowed by so many other great players in a series like that. At one end, he was guarding Bird. At the other end, he was being guarded by Kevin McHale, and he was holding his own both ends. And you kind of forget how great a guy like, speaking of 75 greatest players, you forget how great a guy like that is.
Yeah, and he's a Hall of Famer. You're right. He's a Hall of Famer. A 6'9"-ish guy who was really athletic and could really play. Here's another interesting thing about him, in my mind, is that he was always around phenomenal players.
Yeah.
Even in college.
Yep.
In college, he was teammates with Jordan.
Yep.
He was on one of the best college teams I've ever seen. He gets to the NBA, and he's teammates with Magic and Kareem and that whole gang. So you can say that he was overshadowed by that, but being in that situation might have been good for him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm sure.
He's a really interesting case in terms of his teammates, because he was never the best player on his team,
mm-hmm.
but he's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah,
he's a true Hall of Famer. I'm not questioning that.
No. I mean,
an interesting case, I think.
It is. It is an interesting case, and you know, compiling a list like this, you have some of the same discussions that you do have about Halls of Fame, and just again, I get back to the question: who is good? And, you know, and how good are they? For instance, the examples that I would draw, I mean, in recent years, Bobby Jones and Maurice Cheeks both went into the Hall of Fame. And to me, you know, I'm very pro both of them. And I always had questions about whether either of them belonged. I was happy both of them made it, because if you watched them on the court, they weren't like huge stat guys, but they were like guys who made winning plays. So I always had questions about that. Yes, I thought they were good. I'm sure anybody who loves basketball thought they were good, but are they that good? I mean,
I honestly think they were both marginal for the Hall of Fame.
Right.
Like you, I'm happy they got in.
Right.
Happy they got in. I got an enormous kick out of watching those teams play for the Sixers.
Right.
It's a great time in the NBA. But I think they're marginal. Again, two guys that were better defensively, maybe, than offensively.
Yeah.
It's not so much, because he was a true point guard.
Right.
In the classical sense, but, yeah.
Yeah, so...
We're down a rabbit hole now.
As we often do.
It's not a bad thing.
No, it's never a bad thing in my estimation.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I think we'll probably... call it a day right there, and we'll be talking with you again soon. I'm Gordy, that's Mike, and we'll see you down the road.
See you later.